ESPN Daily is presented by Supercuts, the smarter, easier way to get a haircut. It's not just any haircut. It's Supercuts. So, Sam Borden, I bring you on here because I'm curious, like, what the mood is around these Winter Olympics starting in Beijing, because I feel pretty conflicted, to be honest, about pretty much all of it.
Yeah, Pablo, I would say that it is very much at both ends of the spectrum, right?
Sam Borden is a global sports correspondent for ESPN.
I mean, there's a certain segment of the population that just loves the Olympics. They just love the athletes and the events, many events that they don't watch except for every 4 years, but still love all the same. They love the international component and, you know, the guy from Tonga with grease on his chest walking in for the opening ceremony. They love Chloe Kim and Shaun White and the stars. But I think there's also this unignorable component, particularly with this games, that all of this stuff is happening in China, and China is a complicated place right now. There are environmental concerns about how we're having a Winter Olympics in a place that doesn't have any snow. There are concerns from people about human rights. There are concerns about what's happening in Hong Kong.
The Biden administration will not send any diplomatic or official representation to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics, given the ongoing genocide and other human rights abuses.
When I get right down to it, if you say, what's the overarching mood about these Winter Games? It's confusion. I think a lot of people just don't know how to feel. And I think that that's something that a lot of people, myself included, are struggling with.
The Beijing Winter Games are finally upon us, turning an abstract, far-off conundrum into an immediately practical question. How are we supposed to reconcile any of this? There's the joy of a truly global sporting event that happens once every 4 years. There's the pride you might feel in your country. And then there's this whole frontier of disturbing geopolitical and human rights concerns. So today, Sam Borden explains how and why these Olympics are happening in China and what that might mean for the rest of us. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, February 4th. This is ESPN Daily. So, Sam, the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics are starting very early on this Friday morning, East Coast time. Obviously, most people won't watch them until they air in primetime. I'm just excited to talk to you here because I have many questions about all of this. Like, I have questions that it sounds like you've also been contemplating and, most importantly, reporting here. But just like the practical aspect of how the IOC picked this city in the first place, I understand that some other places had taken themselves out of the running, right?
Yeah, exactly. So the beginning of this story really goes back to 2015. The summer of 2015 is when the vote happened by the IOC, the International Olympic Committee. And that was when they voted on, okay, where are the 2022 Winter Games going to be held? Now, in like the year or two leading up to that, there were a lot of the typical competitors, places you would expect, you know, Norway, the Ukraine. I think at one point, you know, the Pyrenees Mountains in Spain made a bid.
People with snow, in other words.
Yeah, people with snow. People with, like, you know, mountains that you could ski on and maybe even like a ski jump venue or like a sliding track for luge and bobsled, the things that you would expect for a Winter Olympics. But the problem was, as 2015 and that vote came ever closer, one by one, all of these traditional places backed out. And so in the end, it was Oslo, Norway, and then Almaty, which at the time was the capital of Kazakhstan, and Beijing. But about 6 months before the vote, Oslo backed out. And it was in part because of the money that it costs to stage a Winter Games, which has gotten, you know, astronomical. But also there was this sort of storyline that really was embarrassing to the IOC. And it was that the IOC's demands of the cities that host these games had gotten kind of out of control. One of the things that I think Norwegian politicians and Norwegians in general really sort of found to be distasteful was that among the demands that the IOC was making was a requirement that the Norwegian royal family host IOC members. They literally put this in a contract and serve seasonal fruit and cakes to them in their hotel rooms. And all the employees at the hotels where the IOC members were staying had to greet the members with smiles. All of this was like down on paper.
Contractual smiles.
Yeah, contractual smiles, exactly. And they were asking that Oslo cancel school near the sites of the competition to make for less traffic and suggest that residents go on vacation. So all of this just really rubbed the Norwegian people the wrong way. And like many places, they had a referendum and essentially said, we don't support the games coming here. And so Oslo pulled out, and that left not that many great options. It left Almaty, Kazakhstan, and it left Beijing, China.
So the IOC is left with two choices at this point, Sam. Shout out to my freshman college roommate, Kunay Baturbekov from Kazakhstan, from Almaty.
Awesome.
What was Kazakhstan's pitch here?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. One of my great journalistic experiences was early in 2015. I was working at the New York Times and I visited Almaty, and it's, you know, I don't know what your roommate said about it, but it's a lovely place and the people were terrific. I have a Hard Rock Cafe Almaty t-shirt that is one of my prized possessions. Yeah. But I'll say their slogan, their branding for their bid for the Olympics was smart. Their whole like storyline was keeping it real. And it was a not very subtle at all dig at Beijing, because Almaty, which has plenty of problems on its own, it does have snow, though. It does have, you know, some semblance of a winter sports culture and just winter in general. And so its slogan was keeping it real, because everybody knew that whatever Beijing was saying, their entire bid was based on essentially becoming the first Winter Olympic site ever to operate completely with man-made snow and man-made everything else.
Yeah, how did Beijing propose that they were going to pull all of that meteorological wizardry off?
Yeah, I mean, you know, what they said was, well, we're going to use recycled water and we're going to be environmentally friendly and we're going to essentially make snow. In reality, they've been using something like 49 million gallons of chemically treated water frozen through snow machines, something like 100 snow generators, 300 snowmaking guns. And they're essentially just creating a ski slope on a mountain that, if you were to look at it pretty much any other time, would have just been sort of brown, desolate mountain range area. And I think what's kind of interesting about the end result is that you're going to see essentially a Winter Olympics that looks a little bit like a movie set, an Olympic ski slope in the middle of what is otherwise just sort of a barren, empty mountain area.
Wow. Yeah, I want to ask you, Sam, now about this other set piece that occurred, this pivotal moment. Just before the IOC, the 85 members of that organization, voted on these pitches, what happened exactly there?
Let's set this scene, right? The vote happens in July 2015 at a giant convention center in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia. The IOC is gathered there. The committees from Almaty and Beijing have come. They're making their final sort of video presentations. Almaty has as their sort of like main athlete spokesman, a guy named Denis Ten, one of Kazakhstan's most famous Olympic athletes, won a bronze medal in figure skating in 2014. And Denis Ten is a lovely guy and was a great spokesperson, but it was kind of an interesting juxtaposition because Beijing brought Yao Ming as their spokesman.
Of course.
Not a Winter Olympic athlete, but just one of the most famous athletes in the world at the time and still.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's literally towering over all of the Olympic officials and he's shaking hands and he's glad-handing all of these voters. In a lot of ways, it was symbolic of what Beijing's bid was. Their final pitch was essentially, we are the country that delivers. We are the biggest country in the world. We have the most people. We are going to deliver in the same way that we did in 2008, delivered one of the most memorable Summer Olympics. We will do it again in 2022. Right before the final vote, after the presentations were finished, there was a coffee break in the hallway outside this convention center. And all of the people are out there, you know, getting their coffee and sort of milling around. And as soon as everybody was in the hallway, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, hundreds of Chinese just showed up kind of out the window right in front of where all the voters were on the coffee break. And they had this like organized celebration showing the voters, here's how much Chinese people want these Winter Games. It was quite the visual situation for voters to experience right before they went in and cast their vote. And in a lot of ways, it was emblematic of what China does. It was sort of this fictitious, made-up spectacle, but nonetheless, a spectacle that was entertaining and captivating in its own way. In the end, as strong a consideration as Almaty might have been, they lost. Beijing got 44 votes. Almaty got 40. One voter abstained. And the 2022 Winter Olympics are going to a place that has 6 days a year of snow.
Yeah, Sam, I think of a quote that Tony Kornheiser has often quoted to me. It's of former NBC executive, actually, the late, great Don Ohlmeyer, who said, "The answer to all your questions is money." And I understand that that applies here, but I am curious, like, this vote was close, 44 to 40 in favor of China. How much did, like, the human rights record, the other disturbing political issues, how much did the moral qualms factor in?
Honestly, Pablo, my understanding is not very much. There's two reasons for that. The first is that Almaty in Kazakhstan had their own human rights issues as well. And I think the second thing is that at that time in 2015, the notion of China and where it fit into the global sports landscape, it was still sort of drafting off of the 2008 Summer Games experience. Yes. Where China had been more open and somewhat candid even in saying, like, we see this as an opportunity for change. We see sport as a way for us to become part of the larger global community.
Yeah. Yeah, that 2008 Summer Games, Sam, the Michael Phelps summer, it was this pilot program for doing business with China despite these concerns. And I do remember, like, it was sort of a pitch of bring the Olympics here and the world will help open up this country.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So in terms of what has happened since 2008 on the global stage, I mean, Sam, this is, you know, years worth of a college course, I think. But how would you just walk us through how China's approach has changed, not just with the Olympics, but towards the rest of the world in general?
Yeah, I think sort of the overarching thing to keep in mind is that it really has kind of gone back to what it was in, let's say, the 90s or the early 2000s under Xi Jinping. It has become that we are who we are and we don't really care what you think about how we act. There are a couple of issues that symbolize just how uncaring China is about sort of the global response. For me, you know, the repression, the genocide, as some human rights organizations have called it, of the Uyghurs.
Experts tell us 1 million Uyghurs are being held in extrajudicial camps or in prisons. The US calls them concentration camps. China calls them re-education camps.
The crackdown in Hong Kong.
Police were still chasing the protesters. It was the end of an ugly day with street battles that turned into brawls and seemed to go on forever.
And then, honestly, we saw over the last, you know, 4 or 5 months, the terrible controversy involving the tennis player Peng Shui.
China has been facing growing international pressure about the whereabouts of the tennis star. It's still not clear if the champion tennis player is free to be competing again anytime soon.
To me, those are as emblematic as anything of where China is and where China sees itself going forward.
Sam, like, these are issues that we've talked about on this program before. They're issues that demand all of us to go and read up more on exactly what's happening there, because it's incredibly troubling from a human rights perspective.
No, there's no doubt. And I think that, you know, obviously the situation that is most troubling is what's going on with the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. It's difficult for me to sort of break this down into 30 seconds when it's such a complicated issue, but essentially, there's an extermination going on.
China is accused of committing a number of atrocities connected with their mistreatment of its Muslim population.
Another disturbing allegation that the Uyghur population has been forced to engage in slave labor.
Described by some at the highest levels of the U.S. government with one word, genocide.
The Uyghurs are an ethnic group native to Xinjiang, China. They're mostly Muslim. And China and the Chinese government has essentially been trying to exterminate this group. We've seen it through quote-unquote re-education camps. Mm-hmm. We've seen forced sterilization of Uyghur women. We've seen separation of families. You know, China denies all this. They say that they are essentially trying to help the Uyghurs. They're training them for, you know, modern jobs. They're there to combat separatism or Islamic militancy in the region. But human rights groups from all over the world, and even the United States' own Secretary of State, have said this is a genocide that's happening. And I think that's really alarming and really troubling when you then consider that Beijing is about to welcome the world for one of the biggest sporting events on the planet.
After the break, how the challenges facing the International Olympic Committee go much deeper than just China.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with a smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
All of this, Sam, raises questions about how morally compromised the corporations that do business with China are. And this is where Disney and ESPN are in all of these boats that all of these countries seem to find themselves in. But I want to ask you in particular here within our scope of the episode about, like, the IOC as a partner. How are they behaving given all of the concerns and intentions that you've outlined here?
Yeah, there's no doubt that that's one of the things that I think makes people really look cynically at the Olympics is the way that the IOC handles itself. And I think that the situation with Peng Shuai is a really interesting way to show that. So Peng Shuai is a very prominent Chinese athlete. I mean, she won the doubles championship at Wimbledon.
The historic moment for Chinese Taipei. Shi Suwei and Peng Shuai claim the women's doubles title. They will always be able to say, we are Wimbledon champions.
And in November, she posts on social media that she had a relationship with a former vice premier of China and that he had forced her to have sex with him. After that post goes up on the internet, Peng is not seen or heard from for several days publicly.
The latest on the mystery of Chinese tennis star Peng Shuai.
She seemed to disappear from the public for weeks after accusing a former Chinese official of sexual assault.
The head of the Women's Tennis Association questioning the safety of Peng Shuai after receiving what he considers to be a suspect email purportedly from the athlete.
And then there is essentially a smothering that happens. The Chinese government, even in this sort of post-Me Too era, has no reaction, doesn't sort of address or investigate or do anything in regards to what Peng has claimed. And in fact, sort of moves to have her disappear from public life until all of a sudden we see later on that she makes these very sort of orchestrated appearances and at some point even kind of walks back what she had said.
Peng, number one doubles player, has rarely been spotted since posting the assault allegations on social media in November. The post was quickly deleted. Last month, she appeared to backtrack during an interview with a China-friendly Singaporean media outlet, but that did little to reassure people about her safety.
To your question, the IOC gets involved. They say, okay, we're going to help facilitate a conversation between Peng and one of our executives. And we're going to show that conversation to the world as though it's some sort of proof that she's okay and her allegations are being heard and taken seriously, or that she, in fact, she wants to walk them back. And so they have this like staged conversation, a video chat between Peng and the president of the IOC, Thomas Bach. And I think for a lot of people, it just made it seem like, so who is the IOC helping here? Is the IOC helping Peng, one of its athletes, who is making these really disturbing claims? Or is it helping China, which is essentially trying to soft play or soft pedal these claims and move past it so they can go back to just hosting the Olympics? This staged conversation with Bach and Peng didn't really indicate anything other than we're here to try to help China deal with this controversy that the Western world is really focused on right now, whereas China, all they want to do is move on and get back to the sports. And I think ultimately, the IOC, as much as they might say otherwise, they just wanted to get back to the sports too.
Right. No, I think of this quote from John Coates, an IOC vice president, Sam, who said,
"We have no ability to go into a country and tell them what to do. All we can do is to award the Olympic Games to a country under conditions set out in a host contract and then ensure that they are followed."
And Sam, I mean, that idea that all we can do is award the Games to a country and then basically get out of the way, it seems to suggest, I don't know, less autonomy than I would assume of an organization, the IOC, that has made giant geopolitical calls pretty much all the time.
For sure. And it's just crazy, Pablo. I mean, that's the thing. You know, I think anybody with a basic like history understanding of global sport knows that that's not true, right? I mean, like for years, the IOC very much was involved in politics in keeping South Africa out of the Olympics during apartheid, right? That was a political situation that they clearly had no problem getting involved in. And I think that some of the cynicism that people feel towards the IOC is when you hear quotes like you just said from that IOC official, because clearly when it was an African country and it was not necessarily a country that has the same impact in the world, say, as China does right now, they didn't mind getting involved in the politics. But now when we're dealing with China and in a lot of ways, similar types of horrendous, brutal human rights issues, well, all of a sudden, the IOC is not political, right? And I think for a lot of people, that just sort of, it rings very hollow. Like, how is it that you can't affect change? How is it as an organization, the IOC, which wants to be involved and has a permanent observer status at the United Nations, despite the fact that they say that they're not a political organization, and is involved at the last Olympics with North Korea, coming to South Korea and playing hockey with the South Korean team? Like, is that not political? It just feels very selective. And I think China is this monolith. It is this giant, giant figure in the world and in world sport. And so obviously, with everything, the IOC included, there are different rules when it comes to China.
Yeah, Sam, there is a whole convenience to when the IOC wants to do business with autocracies.
And frankly, it's not just the IOC, Pablo. I mean, I don't know if you and I can put this on the calendar right now, but my guess is that there's a good chance we could have a similar conversation like mid-November this year when the World Cup goes to Qatar. You know, it's not just the Olympics, it's global sport in general. And there is a pattern of autocratic regimes becoming sort of the norm for these organizations that are looking to find a venue to host their major events. I mean, just think about what we've seen, right? A Russia Olympics, a Russia World Cup, the Euros, the World Track and Field Championships going to a place like Azerbaijan. Now we've got a Qatar World Cup. We've got a Beijing Olympics. There's championship golf in Saudi Arabia, right? Like, this is not a pattern that is just a coincidence. I always think back, there was a sports official, his name is Gianfranco Casper. And at the time, this is back in 2015, he was the head of the International Skiing Federation. And after the vote on Beijing, he was quoted in a Swiss newspaper saying essentially that the choice of Beijing made perfect sense. This is his quote at the time. He said, "Dictators can organize events such as this without asking the people's permission. For us, everything is easier in dictatorships." Mm. And you know what? Like, he got crushed afterwards and he tried to walk back his statements. He said, "Oh, I you shouldn't take what I was saying literally, but a lot of people in the global sports community, I remember very distinctly after that quote came out, basically just said to each other, like, this guy is just saying the quiet part out loud. You know what I mean? Like, he is just saying what we all know, which is that, like, bottom line, if you're looking to put on a big giant event somewhere that's going to cost a boatload of money and have environmental concerns, and you're going to want to have a bunch of people staying at a 5-star hotel and have, you know, mandatory smiles from the hotel staff, it's a lot easier when you're dealing with people who aren't running democracies.
Yeah, for us, everything is easier in dictatorships is not necessarily what you want on the movie poster. But let's get to why everything is harder, therefore, in democratic countries, Sam, because the question of cost and whether all of this is worth it, not just on the human rights and moral levels, but like the financial level as well. I mean, it seems like that calculus is pretty different if you have the will of the people factored in.
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, I feel like we've talked about this with World Cups. We've talked about it with this Olympics. Like, the scope of these events has become so massive that unless you're talking about a place that has existing infrastructure, like in a lot of ways, the United States or maybe some countries in Europe, like, you're going to end up with these expenditures that displace people, that leave venues that have no use whatsoever. I mean, I always think back to Brazil. I think it was something like 75,000 to 100,000 people were displaced for, you know, the construction of these venues, whether it was for the Summer Games or for the World Cup. One of the stadiums that they had to build in southern Brazil for the World Cup, I think, is now being used as a bus depot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, these ghost stadiums.
Yeah, and all of it becomes really difficult to package in any kind of an attractive way for a voter, for a citizen of a country who you're saying, hey, like, we're going to bring this event here and you guys are going to have to be displaced, or you're going to have to pay more in taxes, or you're going to be stuck with these ghost venues. But you get the honor of hosting the Olympics. That shiny veneer of getting to host one of the events just doesn't exist anymore. And so that's why we've seen all of these events end up going to places where dictators don't have to ask their citizens if they really want it or not.
Coming up, what all of this means for the actual athletes and what they really want.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code DAILY. That's code DAILY. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live. When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
It's worth mentioning, Sam, that the IOC, the Chinese government, not the only players involved here in this power dynamic. They're also, of course, Olympic sponsors. There are broadcasters in America. That is NBC. There are also governments who support their Olympic teams. Like, how do you assess what all of the bodies in this constellation, what are they doing to try and navigate all of the complexity that we've discussed here?
Yeah, it is complicated, Pablo. There's no doubt about it because, you know, like we said at the top, the Olympics is supposed to be this thing that's inspirational and raises people up and you know, moves people in an emotional way. And so generally, those are the kinds of things that politicians or businesses, they want to be associated with, right? But I think that the tricky part about this Games is that all of the issues that we talked about with China have made it a little murkier for each of those entities. And we've already seen Olympic sponsors sort of playing down their connection to this Games. You know, the Wall Street Journal, they noted that Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, these are big time Olympic sponsors, and they didn't do like their typical pre-Olympic advertising blitz ahead of Beijing. And it seems pretty clear that that's because they don't want to necessarily be associated with this event that has these larger concerns hanging over it. We've heard from members of Congress raising concerns about what NBC is going to do. Are they going to sort of, you know, whitewash all of the human rights issues that are hanging over China in their coverage of the Games? And NBC says it's not going to. They're going to focus on the athletes that they always do, but they're going to have China news analysts part of their coverage, and they're going to try to tell the whole story. And then, of course, then you get to sort of the government, and you know, the Biden administration announced that they're going to be a diplomatic boycott of these Olympics.
The White House today declared neither President Biden nor any other American official will travel to the Beijing Winter Games, a diplomatic boycott.
We will not be contributing to the fanfare of the Games.
They're not going to be sending government officials over to Beijing. And, you know, they're not the only country that's doing that. Many other Western countries are following in that same path. And so I think it's fair to say this is really bumpy terrain for all of these entities, and nobody is quite sure what they should do. But I think everybody acknowledges that this Olympics is very different than the ones that we've seen before.
Yeah, so there's this diplomatic boycott, as you just said, of these Olympics. The U.S. government is not participating. They're not attending formally. But the athletes, the people competing in these Games, how does the boycott question weigh on them?
Yeah, it's one of those questions that's been kind of kicked around a lot. And I think fairly. I think, you know, we talk a lot, especially these days, about athletes having a greater voice than they ever have before. And so the question of whether an athlete should use their platform and say, look, I'm not going to go because of where this Games is, I think it's a fair question. I think ultimately I come down on the idea that most Olympians, you know, 70, 75% of Olympians only go to one Olympics. And so is it fair to say to them, hey, you've got to use your one shot to make this larger statement? I'm not sure that it is. One of the people that I spoke to during my reporting for this story was a woman named Angela Schneider, and she's now a professor and an expert on ethics in global sports, but she was an Olympian. She was a Canadian Olympic rower. She won a medal at the 1984 Olympics in Los Angeles, and she told me that she looks back on the 84 Olympics and that medal she won, and she feels like there was almost an asterisk on it because there were a lot of countries who boycotted that Games. The Soviet Union and about a dozen or so other countries boycotted the 84 Olympics because the U.S. didn't go to the 1980 Olympics in Moscow. She looks back on her experience and says, it felt almost incomplete because I wasn't competing against the full field. And so she makes the point that in a lot of ways, it's not a fair ask of athletes. She makes the point that in 1936, if the U.S. had boycotted the Olympics in Berlin the way a lot of people were suggesting they do because of Hitler and the Nazi Party, She says Jesse Owens never would have happened.
Jesse Owens was the fastest human of his day, and he took both the 200 and 100 meter titles. Here's his lightning-like form as he captures the 100 meter in 10.3 seconds. Dufour was furious that his Nordics were unable to beat Owens and refused to present the gold medal to Jesse.
How would not have going to that Olympics been bigger than what Jesse Owens did? And so I think that that debate is always going to exist, but I think ultimately the athletes deserve their right to compete, and it's not necessarily on them to make that statement by showing up or not showing up.
Yeah, I just want to be clear about the power imbalance here, Sam. Like the IOC, geopolitical actor deciding which country to award these games to, like they have all of this influence. The athletes themselves, though, I mean, it's stark how brief their entire life in the sport that they've been training for can be.
I think that's a really fair point, Pablo, and I think it's really well put by you, because you're 100% right. This is their job. The IOC, this is their job. Their job is to navigate these waters, to figure out a place for these Olympics to be held. That's their job. The athlete's job is to compete. Wherever the competition is held, their job is to compete. That's what they're there to do. And so the idea that the power should shift to them, really, in a lot of ways, is crazy when you think about it. You know, these are professional sports executives who are essentially saying, no, we can't do anything. And yet then the expectation shifts onto amateur athletes who are all of a sudden supposed to stand up and do the right thing.
But Sam, let's say they go to the games, these athletes do, and they find themselves still pretty understandably uncomfortable with all of these circumstances. What recourse do they have in terms of protest, let's say, when they get to China?
Yeah, I mean, Pablo, the athlete experience in Beijing is going to be like nothing an Olympic athlete has experienced before. And obviously, look, part of that is the pandemic. And we saw that in Tokyo at the Summer Olympics. And it's going to be even more intense in Beijing in terms of protocols. Then the other part of it is very much about these games being in China. A lot of athletes have been cautioned not to bring their personal cell phones to China because all of the information and security associated with sort of like digital privacy can't be guaranteed by anybody. So officials and athletes, they have to be cautious about what information they're bringing with them that relates to their own personal data. And I think, unfortunately, the guidance that most athletes have received from human rights groups or from national associations is to keep quiet. And that's because we've literally heard Chinese officials say, look, if you're in our country, we are going to enforce our laws. Yang Xu, he's the deputy director general of the Beijing Organizing Committee's International Relations Department. He literally invoked the Olympic spirit when he was given a briefing at the Chinese embassy and essentially threatening athletes who choose to speak out. He said, any behavior or speeches that are against the Olympic spirit, especially against Chinese laws and regulations, are subject to certain punishment. And he said that that punishment can include being thrown out of the Olympics or even arrested. And so you have this situation where human rights officials are saying to athletes, look, we understand you might want to say something, but you should speak when you can. And when you can probably means when you get home.
I wonder just like if you're an athlete, I imagine that some part of you might feel resentful towards the IOC for putting you in a position where this is the Olympics that you get.
I don't think there's any question. I think that, you know, in talking to some athletes, very few, if any, who would want to go on the record, there is that element for sure. The idea that you're an athlete and you're going to these games and because of the pandemic, your family can't come, but you can't even bring your own phone. You can't even post, you know, photos or whatever without some fear of a Chinese hack. Like the whole experience is just very different than what anybody would have imagined. And I think you're 100% right that there is definitely some element of resentment towards the IOC for having created this circumstance where all of these things are happening. the Olympics is just really hard. And it feels like it's getting harder every time. You know, if you're able to like step back and sort of look at it from a 30,000 foot view, it feels a little bit absurd, honestly, right? And look, Pablo, we do this a lot in sports, right? We do this with concussions in football. We do this with steroids or performance enhancing drugs in baseball or other sports. Like, we do this a lot. We have to do this if we want to have any kind of positive feeling about these things, these sports that we love so much. I just think that when you talk about this particular Olympics, the most difficult global event to navigate from an emotional perspective that I think any sports fan has ever experienced.
Sam, I want to root for these athletes. I want to watch them. And at the same time, I want to be very clear about what's actually happening here. So thank you, as always, for giving us a reality check.
Thanks very much, Pablo. Appreciate it.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Ryan Nantel, Mike Philbrick, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tuminello, and Aaron Vale. Special thanks this week to Emma Erdbrink, Garrett Lang, Andres Soto, Christian Gardner, Abu Kamara, Elaine Tang, Mike Drago, and Jackson Angelo. I'll talk to you Monday.